And well, I guess what's most interesting for me is in talking to you guys is, you know, what are your guys' predictions? Vegas over under on on if we have to go back to work in like hazmat suits, or if you know, or if handshaking or the, you know, the kiss on the cheek is even going to be socially acceptable anymore. Like, it, does that change? How do we go to the bathroom, right? Like, you know, when we go to toilet stalls, are we actually going to be touching those handles anymore? Or, you know, is the ghost pooper going to be, you know...
I know, everyone's going to be squatting. The whole world will be squatting. He's ahead of the game.
The ghost pooper had a premonition.
Yes, he knew.
We've come to embrace the term social distancing from the Centers for Disease Control.
That means avoiding group gatherings, plus crowded subways and buses.
Social distancing in action.
Social distancing.
Social distancing.
Social distancing.
The new coronavirus buzz phrase.
Yes, the buzz phrase of the moment is social distancing, also known as don't breathe on me, bitch. Adios en val
con Dios. Don't get overwhelmed by all the panic and fear. I know I spread a lot of panic and fear when I was talking about all this.
I was going to say that the past 50 minutes has all been panic and fear, but okay, go on, George. I'd have no reason to stay.
Adios and via, I don't know how you change the system so that folks aren't just interested in profiting themselves and making themselves wealthier. I don't know.
Communism. Roll a big fat one and grab my guitar and play. Hey, what's going on? Thanks for tuning in to the EWB podcast, part two of the social distancing series, a series where I check in on my friends while the world evolves into chaos. On the phone, I have my very good friend, a previous guest who had talked about paying the price, and is also a hilarious storyteller, Mr. George Wu. How are you?
Hey, Mel. Thanks for having me back. Doing good, doing good.
Dude, thanks for taking the time in all this madness. So, I know Californians in particular really aren't doing anything with the home sheltering right now, right?
Oh, yeah. There's kids all over the place outside. There are actually more kids outside with the shelter in place than before. No, just kidding.
Oh, really? You know, I saw some kind of like a Facebook meme or joke or something the other day where it showed a bunch of kids on their phones and it said the world before the quarantine, and then the second photo is a bunch of kids playing outside and it said, you know, the world after the quarantine. Just a bunch of rebels out there. And, you know, I don't understand this TikTok thing. Myself, but I heard there's a new TikTok challenge where a bunch of kids are going out and purposely coughing and sneezing on groceries.
Like
on produce aisles. So
that's terrible.
Yeah, I mean that's just the dangers of, you know, kids with nothing to do at home. And really, if it's not the virus itself that kills us, it's this the collapse of society because we let these kids run rampant with their social media and their TikTok challenges.
Yeah, I've never actually used TikTok or downloaded it before, so I know very little.
Can you take a picture of your dick and send it on there? Is that, I don't know.
I think that's Snapchat.
Oh,
I've never used Snapchat before either.
Oh, okay, yeah. But otherwise, you know, home sheltering going well. It's, you know, you, Miranda, and Randy the dog.
Yeah, I think we started working from home like almost 2 weeks now. Feels like it's been a while. Apple actually had folks working from home, like, I think earlier than Gilead did. Mm-hmm. And I think we still even have some people who have to go in the lab, and they say that's an essential business to make drugs and stuff. But yeah, you know, it's been good so far. I think main thing is just eating out less, going out less. If you do go out, there's like no traffic, but you do still see some people here and there. But I'm just very appreciative that like we are safe and healthy, because I do know or heard of some folks, coworkers or possibly that may have gotten sick.
You know, and for the most part, because we're young, you know, and Jeff and I talked about this, but because we're young and because, you know, children haven't really been affected by this yet, you know, our concern level's a little bit lower. But you know, you're right. We do work with people that are of an older generation. We have our parents that are near us that, you know, we kind of have to keep an eye on them to see what they're up to, mm-hmm. since they might think that, you know, this is all kind of a little bit hokey, if you will. And they're,
yeah.
You know, your point about, you know, not eating out more and cooking at home, and, you know, it kind of sucks from a social standpoint, but
yeah,
you know, I think we are eating a little bit better. We're probably a little bit healthier and we're saving money.
So. That is true. That is true. Yeah. Have you had to go to the grocery store yet?
Yeah, I have. And everyone makes it seem like it's, you know, shelves are empty and the produce aisle, like the only thing that's left is, like, I don't know, Brussels sprouts. Nothing's really changed. I mean, I've gone to our neighborhood Albertsons, I've gone to the Target, with the exception of toilet paper, everything's still pretty well stocked. I don't know how it is for you guys in the Bay Area.
Yeah, we tried to go to Costco one morning because I think a lot of the online delivery services are like not so like delivering so much anymore. So we went, same sort of experience. I mean, there was sort of a line because they want to keep your distance when you're going in, but inside they had mostly everything at the Costco. Except the toilet paper, paper towels, those just got like bought out super fast. People are just like massively stocking those.
And maybe this is something to talk to someone who's in supply chain about this. But I've been wondering, like I understand, you know, hoarders buying up the toilet paper and, you know, the Purell and the masks is a huge problem. But like, how far in advance do you have to be planning for these sort of things for you to, you know, be able to catch up? Or, like, how quickly can companies actually react to all of this? You know, I don't know if you've read any studies on, you know, how quickly we can, you know, restock all the toilet paper that's, you know, currently hoarded in people's garages. But, you know, more concerning would be the mask thing, right? The N95 masks, where I'm reading that doctors are now, you know, using bandanas as face masks in emergency rooms because there's just such a shortage.
Yeah, so I don't know about regular supply chain stuff. I think it sounds like, from what I've read or anecdotally, that they do have some stockpile, and now it's just sort of they have less. And then as long as deliveries keep continuing to come in, then they're okay. But the one problem, like you mentioned, is these PPE or personal protective equipment, like masks and stuff. There is literally like a huge shortage in supply, and it's very hard to get that from the producers of them, because I think a lot of them are in China, and a lot of our supply chain that's been farmed out in China. So that's why there are some worries about, like, I think some of the common cold medicines, some of the ingredients, they're only made because our whole supply chain is farmed out externally. And then it gets really hard if they shut down or if we somehow lose that sort of delivery process of that supply chain. But the details, I'm not too sure, except personal protective equipment is super scarce and super important to try to get more of.
Man, when we come out the other end of this, you know, we're going to have our president speaking more to the, hey, we got to make everything American made. You know, so this doesn't happen again, and everyone's going to be like, yeah, totally. And then we're going to be paying like $50 for, you know, the cough medicine or something.
It is an interesting discussion. Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, George, I have you on here today for two reasons. One, to talk through the virus spread, the virology aspect of it, because it's somewhat related to your industry, and also the impacts on the economy itself. And you moonlight as an investment analyst. So I do want to hear your thoughts on both of these things. Let's start with the spread of the actual coronavirus. So you work as a biostatistician. Have you studied viruses and the spread of them before?
Yeah. So I am a biostatistician at Gilead. So what I do is essentially for the drugs that we make, we need to make sure that they're safe and effective. So we have to test them in humans in a regulated manner. So these are your clinical trials. And so Gilead has a virology therapeutic area. And I actually work specifically in hepatitis B, the hepatitis B virus. So I do actually have quite a lot of experience working on trials to find treatments for hepatitis B. I don't know
Don't shit on dirty toilet seats. That's how you don't get hepatitis B, right?
So it turns out I think for it's different for different viruses. So some viruses can spread through the air. So whether that's through like droplets that they're talking about on our aerosol, which is kind of like a fog, misty kind of thing. Viruses like HPV, they're primarily spread through like blood. So if you share needles, semen, sex, other bodily fluids. And then for a lot of Asian countries, it's actually from mother to child. Because they didn't have vaccines as earlier and they had some bad practices back then. So a lot of newly infected kids who have chronic hepatitis B is from their mother. But I guess the one thing what I would say about it, less so about how viruses are spread, but the one thing I would probably emphasize is that, I don't know if you guys have heard or you've heard that there's certain, like they've been saying, there's that malaria drug. Yeah. How do you say that?
It's a mouthful, yeah.
Soroquine. And then even Gilead ourselves, we have an Ebola drug called remdesivir, and we're running trials for it. But that part is really, really necessary because you don't know when you repurpose a drug for a different disease to a new disease, how safe and effective it would be. You know, for the most part, you would hope a lot of the safety things, if it was safe, will translate over. But you're not sure about the efficacy because some folks will just naturally cure themselves or respond well over time. And it gets very, very hard to figure out what those underlying factors are for a given patient. So maybe they're older, they had some pre-existing conditions and all these things. So the only way to really get at that answer is you basically have to randomly assign treatment drug and control to compare them. And by randomizing, you're sort of balancing out those factors so you know that on average at the end, whether or not it was truly effective or not. When you're going through this process, there's a lot of ways to sort of bias your interpretation or results, because if you know what treatment the person had, then you might bias in the way that you measure them, or you might, you know, treat them a little differently. Or if you assign treatment to, say, folks you think are a little healthier, or in these kind of subjective things can really mess with how you interpret the difference you see in the end. So it's really important to sort of randomize and then sort of have what they're called double blind trials, where you don't know who got the treatment, who got the control, to do those assessments, so it's not impacted by those biases.
Yeah, and it's also important to have subjects of similar health, age, demographic, right?
Yes.
Because,
yes.
You know, like you were saying, who knows why people were affected by this more so than others, and B, why some people were able to recover a lot easier than others.
Yes.
And, you know, there's all these factors that play into this that it really would be hard to find a group that all kind of have the same stats and that you can actually compare apples to apples.
Yes.
So I was listening to a clip from Dr. Oz. And he was saying, I don't know if you saw the same one. He was being interviewed by Fox News, and he said two numbers. He talked about a 6-day thing and a 20-day thing. Do you know what he was referencing about that?
I don't think I've seen that clip. Mm-hmm. Was he talking about like a range of when you're supposed to have symptoms, or?
Yeah, no, it was too medical mumbo jumbo for me. I didn't know what I was really listening to, and
I guess we can talk about like how does the virus actually hurt the person? I guess Tan would know more, but I can try to explain some of that.
Yeah. Well, Tan's I really do want to get Tan on the pod for part three of this series. Stay tuned. But, you know, with him kind of on the front lines and, you know, fighting the virus with with a dishcloth covering his mouth, you know, we'll see. We'll see if we're able to get him on. So by all means, George, please explain.
A virus is basically comprised of a small piece of genetic information, so that can be called DNA or RNA. It's housed inside a protein's shell. And it's not really like a living organism. It's sort of just like a replicative thing that's there. I don't know if that's the best way to say it. And what it does, its sole purpose is just to proliferate and then genetically reproduce by hijacking your host cells. So when a virus comes in, whether it's through someone coughed on you, some other ways of sharing bodily fluids. Once it enters, usually viruses are targeted to a particular type of cell, whether it's a liver cell for HPV, or I believe coronavirus, it goes to the back of your throat. And what it does is it enters into those cells, and it will hijack that cell factory, basically, to start producing itself. and more of itself, and then continue to produce and release more and more viruses. Sometimes you just produce a lot and then your cell dies and all the viruses explode and they go and infect further cells. And so one effect of this is that those healthy cells will die or get damaged. And the second effect is that your own body will know that this is occurring, and you'll have an immune response in which it will start attacking infected cells and will also start sort of a more general immune response. And this causes a lot of inflammation and damage. So for a lot of coronavirus folks, for example, I think the virus gets into like their lung area, and then you start having people get pneumonia because their lung cells basically start having fluid buildup or pus buildup. And that's a result of this sort of inflammation fever response that your immune system goes through. And so your immune system, basically you, your body is sort of hurting yourself because this virus is triggering all these reactions. And that's primarily how viruses really damage the human body. And the thing is, some viruses, so I mentioned how there's like DNA, RNA, some viruses, basically they don't go into what's the nucleus of your cell, sort of like the brain of your cell. It kind of stays on the outside, inside of your cell, but not in your brain area, and it'll produce. But what you can do is you can find a drug that shuts down this reproduction part. So it'll break down that production process. But some of the other viruses like HIV or HBV, they're trickier. What they do is they go into the nucleus of your cell, which is like the brain of your cell, and then gets embedded into your genetic code. Or in HPV's case, it acts like another chromosome that's super stable. And then once it's in there, it's really, really hard to stop that production. It's even hard to measure how much is in there. And basically, the infected cell is like a zombie cell that's just continuously producing more and more of the virus. And then sometimes your immune system, if it gets used to this, especially for children who got virus from their mother, their immune system don't even recognize these cells as like cells that need to be killed. Yeah, invasive. And then it just chronically produces viruses. So some of those viruses are much, much harder to deal with. And currently, we don't actually have any cure for them. What we do is we just suppress the amount of virus that's being produced on the outside, but we can't actually destroy those factories, those hijacked factories. Thankfully, for coronavirus, what I believe, I think it's an RNA virus, you can actually, hopefully, with all these new drug treatments, is to stop that reproduction process. And then some other treatments, I think some of these malaria ones or other ones, are sort of tackling your immune response and making sure your immune response doesn't go haywire and like shut down your lungs due to inflammation or other things that get triggered.
Mm-hmm. And this might be a little bit off topic, but is that similar for suppressing your immune response? Is that kind of similar to what allergy meds do, essentially?
Just reduce
what your body does when it thinks it has this poison. I don't call it poison, but this.
Yeah. I think so. I believe so. So there's other things like allergies or rheumatoid arthritis, which is a disease in which your immune system attacks your joints, and nothing's really going on there, but your immune system's just gone haywire. And so you just have to find a way to really shut down that inflammatory response. I guess what I would mention here is, I think they found that some patients, especially some younger folks that suddenly die very quickly, they have some what's called a cytokine storm. And it's at a certain point where your immune system feels so overwhelmed and the release of so many toxic chemicals and stuff and signals, inflammatory signals, that it just starts going haywire. And you can really, really quickly die from these things. So you need something to completely, you know, shut down your immune system at that point in time. Otherwise, very quickly, you're going to have very, very negative results, most likely death.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So are there, I don't mean for this to be a joke, but if our immune response is partially what's killing us, then is there something that another virus that can come help suppress the immune response? I mean, like when people say their immune system compromised, right? Does that mean that their immune system is, you know, like you're saying, overreacting and causing the death, or is it just not working at all? Because if there's a way to shut down the immune system, period, I assume that'd be very dangerous for other things. But if that would at least get us over this hump while the coronavirus is causing our immune system to kill ourselves, wouldn't that be kind of a way to stopgap it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point and a good question. I think
did I just did I just solve the problem of the coronavirus on the Wayne Bang Pod?
So I guess I should qualify my statements ahead. Is the usual response with a lot of the mild symptoms, especially in the younger folks with stronger immune systems, is their immune systems can handle the virus. So they have an immune response that minimizes the virus reproduction, so it's not too crazy. They don't get too strong of symptoms, and their immune system is able to clear the virus over time. And that's usually like the standard case that doesn't get too serious. But then if you have existing comorbidities or you're immunocompromised in some way and your immune system is weak and the virus is allowed to replicate a lot and get into all different kinds of places, that's when you hit that point where it gets overwhelming amount of inflammatory and immune response where you're really, really in big trouble. And that's where something can come in, whether it's a drug or I don't know if it's possible to engineer something. I don't think we have that technology yet, but maybe in the future that can sort of directly shut down your immune response at one time. What I would say is there are treatments called CAR T treatments. They're really new technologies, which basically take your own T cells, your own immune cells, and modify them to attack cancer cells. So this has been really a life transforming new technological process where you can develop these T cells and has cured cancer for folks that never had a chance of being cured. They would have died in like within a month or so. But the same thing happens is if those immune T cells go haywire and start attacking not only your cancer cells, but everything very quickly, they go through that same cytokine storm situation and then they just basically die. So then they have these drugs. I don't remember what the names are that they can eat to sort of shut everything down in the meanwhile, while they try to figure out what went wrong, to try to save their lives before that cytokine storm kind of reinitiates.
Gotcha. So they need to save you before you become zombies, like the movie Resident Evil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you seen Resident Evil? How do you put it? Is the T-virus reference just going over your head? All right, fine.
I remember Umbrella Corp. So some people think they have a conspiracy theory where they think it started in like a lab in Wuhan.
Yeah. I don't know
if you heard about that. Some sort of more qualified virologists and scientific folks say that's a complete hoax. And some of the people say, like, there's just no way that you could have a virus that can be so well adapted to the human system without having someone try to, like, unnaturally, experimentally select for a virus like this.
So do viruses evolve? They do, right? I mean, the flu does. So maybe it was just so insignificant for so long that, you know, it reached a tipping point where, you know, the floodgates opened and our bodies couldn't handle it. I mean, I'm sure humans, you know, have evolved as, you know, themselves. I mean, our resistance to disease, you know, from generation to generation, I assume has improved.
Yeah, so absolutely true. So one of the, I guess, why viruses are so resilient is because they can mutate a lot. And they're actually really, really small sequences of nucleic acids or genetic information. And they're not very long, but they're able to mutate. So then they can develop different functions over time and change to adjust to whatever, like, our immune system or drug is doing to them. And they can mutate a lot. And the thing is, what's really cool is you can look at these sequences within patients. So I think this happened with one of the Seattle studies is they found a patient and they looked at the sequence of the virus and they were basically able to trace it to, I think the same sequence was in someone from Wuhan or something. So they could tell approximately at what time they would have had been affected, which is like super early. I think it was, I don't remember what the time frame was, but much more before people were even aware the virus was already spreading. And they can tell basically these sort of lineages, like, is the Italy virus folks, are they from China? Are they from you? Like, they can tell these sort of origin or sources because you can trace these sequences of mutations to see sort of where their family or lineage came from.
Is that information that we can use? I assume it's information that we do use to.
So I think what the scientist said, I think his name was Travis. I can't remember the exact. But anyhow, what he said was
Travis.
I think his name was Travis. I saw it on Twitter.
Not Connor. Not Buck. Okay. The white names that I could think of. Yeah, go on.
But basically because he was looking at the sequences and he's saying like, oh, it probably matches virus origin from Wuhan or wherever it was. And he estimated the amount of time it must have been here and that person must have been infected with the virus. And then based on the R naught, which is how fast or how quick the virus spreads, he estimated that like a couple thousand people in Seattle in that area were already infected when at that time, due to limited testing, I think we only had like a couple hundred cases. So from like a scientific perspective, they could trace and say, how many do they think are currently really infected now?
And they're probably right. It's, the reality is, you know, with the whole fiasco of the limited testing, you know, there's probably so many more. And I guess somewhat related to that, and talking about exponential growth of the number infected, you know, what do you think is the kind of the worst case scenario? Or do you think this is the worst kind of pandemic that can happen to mankind?
Overall, I think things are going to be better than we expect, but it depends on what you expect. So I think one of the big things is a lot of folks, when they see only a few cases, especially at the start, they're thinking, we don't have an issue here. But with exponential growth, the way if, like, say, something doubles, it grows very, very quickly. So just for example, like if you can imagine something that's like, say the virus is doubling, it's not doubling, but if it is doubling, for example, when you hit, let's just say 6%, you're like, oh, that's no problem. But let's say it doubles like every day, for example, right? 6 becomes 12, becomes 24, becomes 48, and then you're at 100% and only like 5 days later. Because our minds are just not able to wrap around that exponential curve growth, and we think in a little more linear fashion. So when you see those very few cases, like I think I did this exercise when I saw that we had only like 100 some cases in the U.S. If you just 150 cases in the U.S. and you track how other countries, the growth of the virus was at that time, like in a week is like 1,000 and it grows up quickly, very, very quickly, 10,000, hundreds of thousands. So I think they've had some studies there. I don't remember what the numbers exactly were, but they were like a shocking amount of people that could be infected. And then if you use whatever you estimate as your death rate, whether it's 1%, 0.1%, 3%, it was at least, okay, I don't want to say the number wrong, but I think it was really, really high. It was definitely in the hundreds of thousands or millions, but it was like a shocking amount because when they compared it with like the amount of people who died from past wars, it's something like 10 times the amount or way more, a much more significant amount. But that is assuming that we don't do anything to deter the exponential growth. So I think that's where it's sort of one set of people aren't aware of how bad it can get due to the exponential growth. And they say, oh, everything's fine. The numbers are small. This isn't going to happen to me. And then there's another set of people who realize exponential growth. And then they sort of model it out and say, oh, my God, it's going to be so many people. This is horrendous. What I think is maybe one step further is we're going to do stuff to try to slow down this exponential growth. So here, I'm sure you guys must have seen this, the whole flatten the curve thing so you don't overwhelm the healthcare system. Also social distancing, trying to test and identify and isolate. Like that whole series of steps, the USA and Europe and Iran, they just completely missed out on. And we have such serious problems now because of that. If we were like South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, which did really good very early on, and then I think they even used like sort of your phone and tracking QR codes to identify folks and see where they are. And if you had the virus, you try to stay home. And then if you, you know, washed your hands, you wore masks, you kind of kept your distance from folks, it can greatly, greatly slow down and even almost stop the spread of the virus. And that completely gets you out of that exponential growth stage. But if you're not doing that, and if you're like you mentioned before, handshaking, kissing when you greet, going out to parties, mingling all the time, and you're not doing social distancing, then the exponential growth is going to happen. And then that outcome can be really, really bad because the key thing here isn't necessarily whatever death rate we're observing in other countries. It's when your healthcare system gets overwhelmed. There are statistics out there. Again, I don't know off the top of my head, but basically there's only a certain number of beds and certain number of ventilators available in hospitals. And then a lot of folks who have serious cases, they need to go to the hospital, get on a bed, and they need to get it's called intubated. Basically, they need help breathing. And we don't have enough of those machines around for everyone. And if you do get the treatment and support, most likely you're not going to die. But if you don't have it available and you're completely overwhelmed, then a lot of folks are going to die, especially a lot of elder folks. And that's what's happening in Italy right now, in Iran. And I think even right now, as we're speaking in New York, there are hospitals, I think I've seen or read, that are hitting that point. And when you hit that point, any more people that come in, you can't give them the proper treatment, and then your fatality rate is going to go much, much higher. And so we have to do everything we can to not hit that point in time.
Yeah. And to your point about tipping points, I think there's going to be some really interesting studies that will come out in the future about cultural differences and how vast majorities of populations were willing to take on this attitude of, you know, social distancing or home sheltering, or really even the whole lockdown scenario, which was seen as extreme in cities like Wuhan. But the reality is, you know, I think Americans just carry themselves with this level of arrogance where they think, oh, those are different kinds of countries. It won't happen to us. I think Italy, you know, some of the Italians that you see on YouTube clips talking about this, they kind of share the same sentiment where it's like, oh, you know, we didn't think it would happen to us. So we continued, you know, going out and hanging out in crowded places. You know, we regret doing that. So I think it's one of those interesting, like, kind of Malcolm Gladwell-y sort of things where he'll probably go into, oh, you know, because Asians come from this, you know, background of respect, you know, they were more willing to follow this sort of direction than, you know, Americans who are taught to, you know, rebel and stand up for themselves and live out their free lives that our founding fathers fought for, you know, that sort of bullshit. Like, that's probably what contributed to the lack of seriousness that people took in dealing with this pandemic. Also, a funny thing in my mind is, you know, and I'm sure this might end up being like some kind of SNL skit one day, is, you know, trying to explain to Americans, you know, what does exponential growth actually mean, right? Trying to explain it, like, with numbers. Like, they're probably going to sit there and be like, no, I don't get it. Like, you have to show them, like, and you only have, you know, 10 fingers and 10 toes, so.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, the whole difference between cultures and environment, and just even now, even with all the sort of seeing how the virus numbers are growing, the attitude of folks who are like, oh, it's my spring break in Florida. Oh my God, like, I don't know if you've seen those beaches. Oh, they're just packed.
Yeah.
Governor is like, no, this is fine. I'm like, man, like, you know, I know you're at lower risk, but there's elderly folk there and you're just, you know, there's a risk of spreading the virus. Like, we got to do something. Like, if these hospitals get overwhelmed, it's just a short time away, literally like a week or two away. It's just that short. It just seems like it's not going to happen to me, basically.
Yeah. Well, it's Florida. We could afford to lose them. So how does this end? How do you think this all ends?
So I usually pretty pessimistic, but maybe I'll be a little more optimistic. So I guess maybe we can talk about maybe the sequence of things happening.
Okay.
I think that the virus growth is going to continue for a while, even with these initial shelter at home sort of practices in place. And that's just because, you know, folks are still going out. And then also due to our limited testing, and I still feel like we're just barely starting to catch up in testing in the U.S. There's a lot more infected folks than we know about. Thankfully, most of them are going to be mild and asymptomatic, but we're going to hit that point within a week. I don't know if it's been like 2 weeks since then, but maybe a week or two, where we will start seeing hospitals being overwhelmed with folks. And we're also going to see hospital frontline employees like nurses and doctors run out of personal protective equipment, which will likely lead them to get affected. And it's very possible that because they're around the virus so much, they may have much more severe outcomes, and there'll be a moment of sort of crisis in that sense. So I think what the steps are going to be is, as that's progressing toward there and things do get worse, and this is going to happen very soon, like in a week or two or three, then we'll hit that point where it's not just going to be shelter in place. I think that they will have almost sort of like martial law, military style lockdown. And I do know some cities or governors are requesting for the National Guard to show up. So I don't know if you've seen on Twitter pictures of tanks in New York and army people setting up there to try to start converting some of the buildings in New York into potential hospitals, because that's what they had to do in Italy. They had to convert places, build hospitals, just like China with the whole build a hospital in 5 days type thing, just to start taking in all these folks. But on the flip end, I don't think it's going to be a continuing exponential growth where it's going to go crazy. I think that some of the drugs that are potentially going to be useful, like we're basically going to find something. I think vaccines will take at least a year or more to release eventually, but I think we'll have a drug, whether it's Gilead's, whether it's chloroquine, that hopefully will be able to be approved by the FDA within, in my guess, 2 months. So we'll probably see some results, I know, from Gilead trials, at least in like mid-April, for example. And hopefully that'll be positive news. I think anecdotally what I've heard is a lot of these drugs are actually helping a lot. So I think it's just a matter of going through that approval process, although it can take some time. And when those drugs come out, then at least they'll be able to help folks who are really sick and help them hopefully, you know, suppress or cure this virus. I would caution, though, that this initial phase, and this is sort of what the concern is with sort of just letting the virus run rampant to build herd immunity, is some concerns like UK, I think, is it Denmark or Netherlands, where they just said, like, let's just let the virus run rampant. It's going to affect people. Some people are going to die. Okay, we're going to get herd immunity. We don't want to shut down the economy. Is the reason why they were thinking about that was because some people suggest that, okay, you isolate, you quarantine, you shut down, but once you release people back, then more folks are going to get infected and you're going to have like a second phase. So this happened for like one of the Spanish 1918 flu virus, which was super bad, worse than this one, infected like 1/4 of the world's population, killed like 2% of the world's population, and had multi waves. And sometimes the second wave was just as strong or stronger than the first wave. There is that potential here as well, is that we all social distance, we finally get a control, our hands around it, and then we gradually start loosening, and then that's when the virus starts coming back. So this is actually starting to happen a little bit in like Taiwan and Singapore, because folks from US and Europe are coming
importing
back.
It back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I think that's funny. Like the way you're describing it is like at the end of a, you know, like a zombie movie where it's like, oh, okay, everything's under control again, and then, you know, the guy in the lab knocks over that vial that had a question mark on it, and then it's like, oh, okay, it's gonna start again. Yeah. I number one, you know, great shameless plug for your company. Okay, I guess I'm gonna invest in Gilead now. Number two, I see the challenge that it's not so black and white where it's like, okay, everybody has to shelter at home. You know, like in theory, it sounds right, but I can see where other people are coming from, where they're like, hey, it's very nearsighted to think like that. Like maybe, you know, the best way to manage this pandemic is to, you know, take some losses. And some of that, unfortunately, might have to be human losses. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I could see where that thought comes from. And I'm sure there's various studies that talk about that. As a side note, one thing I heard about the Spanish flu is that part of the reason why it was so rampant was had something to do with World War I and how we were moving wounded soldiers around.
Oh, interesting.
Like how they were getting moved, you know, kind of far away to be treated. So like if you're out in the battlefield in the middle of in the countryside of Europe somewhere and you got hurt or you got sick, you know, you'd be shuttled far away to some hospital where, you know, a bunch of sick people are congregating. And then, you know, from there you get shuttled back home because you get discharged since you don't have your leg anymore. So part of that had to do with the war itself, you know, how we handled the wounded and the sick.
Yeah.
Lucky for us, we don't necessarily have a war going on, but unfortunate for us, travel is still pretty convenient for people. Let's wrap this up with talking about investments. I mean, you're a finance guy. My 401k, I'm sure, is taking a hit. I'm young, so I don't really care. I'm sure it's going to bounce back. But what do you see happening?
Finance these days the finance world has been very interesting. Again, I guess I would caution that I'm just a hobbyist, so this is not financial advice. But what I would say is embedded in this is there's this whole health issue and then our reaction to it because we wasted so much time not testing and trying to isolate folks early on to control it. And now it's sort of out of control. So we're taking on these more extreme measures. So when you have a shelter in place, a lot of businesses, restaurant, retail, these type of small businesses get hurt very, very badly. So I looked up a report that I saw, a JP Morgan Chase report, where they have folks, business, small business accounts. And then they basically saw that the average small business has only 27 days of cash buffer on hand. And some of the lower tech ones, like restaurants, repair, maintenance, and retail, only have 17 days. So that means that if you shut down in terms of your revenue and you don't have money coming in, you're only going to last a month or half a month before you're potentially going to go bankrupt. And a lot of these, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, that's shocking, but it's true. And we've seen it here. Like, even before the shelter in place thing started becoming a strong recommendation in the Seattle area, I had heard about a bunch of restaurants that I thought were doing great that had to be permanently shut down for this mm-hmm. reason. Like, it mm-hmm. was, you know, people weren't going anymore. And within 2 weeks, they were done.
Yep. Yep. It's shocking how fragile it is. And the thing is, small businesses, defined as like less than 500 employees, is about 50% of all U.S. employment. And the stats that they ran off was about 99% of all businesses. So most businesses are not your Amazon and your Microsoft. It's these small businesses. And so what is really, really concerning is when you take more lockdown type steps and these businesses start closing and start firing and laying off folks, this is not stuff that goes away very quickly and rebounds very easily. And these unemployment numbers are going to start shooting up. So they've already seen a lot more unemployment, like whatever benefits when you do Google searches, when the next economic reports come out, you can definitely see a lot of folks becoming unemployed. And that is going to have a substantial impact on the economy, especially over time, because, you know, these folks run out of money. They don't have money. They don't buy stuff. The businesses who need their revenue, so on. And then it just sort of propagates through this whole entire, you know, economic chain. So that's with respect to these sort of small businesses. And it's a huge concern. I don't really know what we can do. I guess what the government is doing is, I heard they're doing like a $1 trillion, $2 trillion stimulus bill to try to help out some of these folks. My main worry is that they're going to put a lot of spending to bail out large corporations like the airlines and casinos and cruise lines. And most folks probably don't know about this, but for like these larger companies, like for example, airlines, yes, they're important structure in your economy and also for the country. But for the past few years, when things were going really well, they've been basically doing stock buybacks. And so all the money that they've been making, they've been using to buy their own stock. And what happens is, that way, you know, the price goes up, everything, their PE ratio goes up, everything looks really great. And then their CEOs and people with a lot of stock get compensated very heavily instead of saving that money or investing that money. And then once they've spent all their money that they've made buying back the stock, enriching themselves, then they say, oh, shoot, black swan happens, shit happens, and I need money. I need a bailout from the taxpayer. It's like, what the heck? Like, you can't just like basically enrich yourself when things are well, and then when things go crappy, expect that the U.S. taxpayer is going to bail you out. Go ahead.
So who, and maybe this is going into the government stuff, which is definitely not an expertise of the Yuang Bang pod, but how do we decide where that stimulus money goes? Is that even something that we as regular citizens can good, have, yeah. have feedback on? Or is it just putting in the trust of our officials that we elected, who in turn, you know, are paid off by the rich people who tell them to vote for the, you know.
I think it's most likely that case. I don't really know the details myself, but yes, I think for the most part, the way the American system works is you have these companies with lobbyists, and then they pay off these people who make the law and who decide where this money goes. And this is sort of what happened in the great financial crisis in 2008. We bail out all the big banks. And this is actually happening again this time around, except this time it's not the banks, it's these large hedge funds. So this is where basically they're making these huge bets based on treasuries, and they're called arbitrage trades. So basically it's like when two things are supposed to go together in normal circumstances, and just a very small difference between them that over time will resolve. If you, and it probably resolves like 99% of the time, if you take that small minuscule profit and then you leverage it up like 10x, 100x, then you can actually make a decent amount of money when most of the time there's no problems. And so that's what these large hedge funds are doing and making money off of it. But then when you have a black swan event like this virus, and that 99% is no longer there, and you're in the 1% time when these things blow out further and there's huge leverage, then these funds are basically like they're gonna basically go broke because they get what's called like a margin call. Is basically they're having too many losses and they don't have enough money to for whoever they loan from for the leverage to convince them that it's still safe. And at a certain point, they'll basically say like, okay, this is like 50% of how much money you have. You have to sell everything right now. So what hedge funds in this situation, what's happened is they reached the Fed, the central bank of the United States, basically loaned them money in a sense. So they have something called repo, and it's basically, it's a way to provide money and liquidity to folks who need money at that time. And so I don't know if you remember last Sunday, the Fed suddenly made this announcement dropping interest rates to 0%, and they're going to raise this repo to like a huge amount. And they're like, why did they do this on a Sunday instead of when they had a meeting on Wednesday, when they typically are supposed to make more formal announcements? Like, what's the rush? And the rush was basically there were a series of hedge funds that were in this business that were going to go bankrupt and then like crash the system because a lot of people were dependent on them being around. And so they basically, the Fed is different than the, you know, the government fiscal stimulus. They have their own. They can make their own decisions on giving out money in a certain way. They have certain constraints. One of those ways is the repo. So they can just directly say, okay, we're providing repos, and then now we're going to give these hedge funds money to hold over until some of this volatility dies down so their trades don't blow out anymore, and then save their butts, basically. And they're making these huge bets, making tons of money. And here we are, the regular person is – like paying them off for these bailouts, just like the banks back in the great financial crisis. It's ridiculous.
It's disheartening. And, you know, it's almost like, man, I'm comfortable with where I am and I'm happy with my salary. Like, I don't want to worry about these things. But, you know, hearing about it from people like you and reading about it is infuriating. And it's probably one of the reasons why people are going to take, you know, elections a lot more seriously, which is, you know, myself included, it's sad that before this, you know, it was just kind of like, well, as long as I have a job and I'm comfortable, I'm okay, happy as a clam.
I guess what I would say is, I would just add is, so a lot of the volatility that we're seeing in markets currently, like mm-hmm. This has been like the fastest 30% drop ever, mm-hmm. correction ever, even worse than like 1929 depression recession thing, is because of these folks with these leveraged positions that are basically, getting blown out. And so when they get blown out, they have to sell everything. So things just drop like crazy. And it's like it's a feedback loop. And then so if the Fed and folks don't step in, then it's just going to keep dropping. And then all us regular folks with 401ks are going to be like lose our savings because they've had these uncontrolled bets in place. And what it is actually, it's something that's systematically been happening sort of since the great financial crisis and even beyond that, is basically our approach to corrections, to economic issues, is basically to provide more money out there. And so the idea is if things go bad, there is a Fed put. The Fed is going to make things good. And so they won't let any correction, any economic situation happen. So you'll have, and they'll continue lowering interest rates. So you'll have these companies who have access to, say, these low interest rates survive when they shouldn't be. They're like zombie companies. So in Japan, this has been happening. They have a bunch of zombie banks that are not profitable. They're just around because they have these 0% interest rates and they can just survive. And it's just a drag on the economy. And they don't basically allow any sort of economic situation or recession to really occur. And sometimes you need these recessions to occur. So the analogy or metaphor that I've seen very often is sort of like fire control. If you basically try to shut down every single small fire, then the one day when you have a big fire, it's huge and it just like crushes everything. But if you have controlled fires where you just let the fire go, small ones every once in a while, and you let that natural process happen, you don't have these huge fires that go insane. And I think they have these two
I don't know, parks or areas, and they show that this is the case if you allow these natural things to happen. The problem is we're not allowing it to happen, and our solution is to continuously pump out more money to save folks, and the folks we're saving are the rich folks, and we're just making the system even more fragile. So let's say coronavirus gets cured down the line, 3-6 months, it's not a big issue. All the stimulus that's coming through could very potentially take the markets to new all-time highs, but the fundamental issue is not resolved. At a certain point, it will just get worse later down the line. And that's the really concerning part. When I say worse, they're even imagining like the way our finance works currently will completely change. There's a lot of details around that. I don't know if it's ever going to get there, but it can get really, really, really bad.
So invest in gold is what George Wu is saying. Just stock up on gold bricks.
Bitcoin?
fuck Bitcoin. So what's your final advice then for me, people like me and you, with some things going our way? You know, decent 401k, decent investments here and there. You know, investment in real estate. You know, with the low interest rates, does everybody refinance on their homes? What was the best, most obvious steps right now?
Yeah. So I think the safest thing to do, and what I would do, is you don't have to be in the market 100% all the time. I know there's the buy and hold philosophy, and in the long run, things will bounce back. But what I would say is when things get very volatile, just lower your exposure. So let's say you have 100% of your stuff in stocks, and then coronavirus hits, market starts dropping, it's really volatile, goes up 10%, down 10%, limit up, limit down every day. Just take more of that money out, put it on the side, and put it in something very safe, like, say, a money market. Just lower the exposure and just basically say, I'm not going to play any game right now. It's kind of like if you're playing poker and you're on tilt, then basically step away or like start betting in smaller amounts. When you suddenly have these big losses, then I'm going to go to a lower denominated table. So I'm not going to play $100 no limit. I'm going to play $10 no limit until I feel more confident or better, and then come back in. Of course, don't forget to come back in. I think a lot of folks get scared away completely, and they never came back in since 2008. And then you missed on the financial market run up. Because ultimately, I think the way things are working these days is that the government will do everything they can to make sure that the financial markets are okay until the one day it doesn't work anymore. But most likely what's going to happen is we probably will have a recovery. In the meanwhile, just do your part, stay home, stay safe, socially distance. Don't get overwhelmed by all the panic and fear. I know I spread a lot of panic and fear when I was talking about all this.
I was going to say the past 50 minutes has all been panic and fear, but okay, go on, George.
It'll be better than the way that I put that it sounds. I think that we will find a cure, or we'll find a vaccine. We will put in the proper things in place so it doesn't go too crazy, doesn't spread too much. And then the economy will rebound from here, and this volatility will go away eventually. But at the same time, there's some things that just need to be changed. And if they don't change, we're just going to continue to run into these kind of problems again. I don't know, like you said, how to make these changes occur. And they're just sort of there. Most folks probably aren't aware of them, but they can have very big repercussions down the line. It's just how do you change the system so that folks aren't just interested in profiting themselves and making themselves wealthier? I don't know.
Communism. Nobody gets money. Only a select few gets money. The rest of us, everyone else just becomes poor and works in the field. That's my solution. George, thank you so much. And this is way more informative than I thought it would be. And I think myself and the three listeners that we have will benefit greatly from the wisdom that you've shared.
Thank you for having me. I apologize for all the panic and fear that I was spreading. I would say at the end of the day, really, it's about appreciating what you have. And I do feel very appreciative that we do have pretty stable jobs. You have a new son. We are healthy. And there's a lot of great things that are in our lives. And I think focusing on those things and then being happy is the best way forward.
Word. And next time I have you on here, I want to hear another story about poop, because this has just been too depressing. All right, George, thanks so much. Take care.
All right. Thanks, man. I got my toes in the water, ass in the sand, not a worry in a world of cold beer in my hand. Life is good today. Life is good today. Adios and bye, con Dios. A long way from GA. Yes, and all the muchachas, they call me Big Papa. When I throw pesos their way, adios and bye, con Dios. A long way from GA. Someone do me a favor and pour me some Jaeger, and I'll grab my guitar and play.